Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 225, The Neuroscience of Meditation, with Sarah Lazar. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Meditators, these guys have been practicing for years, 40 minutes a day for years. You know, maybe there'll be some differences in their brain and actually how much gray matter they have. So we looked, and lo and behold, they had more gray matter in the insula, which again is this really cool area, as well as areas involved in sensory awareness. So for instance, the area representing the diaphragm was a little bit bigger. Also areas of visual cortex and auditory cortex were bigger. And finally, an area in the front of the brain that's involved in a sort of attention and working memory was also bigger.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Sarah Lazar, speaking about her research on meditation and the plasticity of the brain. Sarah W. Lazar, Ph.D., is a neuroscientist in the psychiatry department at Massachusetts General Hospital and an instructor in psychology at Harvard Medical School. The focus of her research is to elucidate the neural mechanisms underlying meditation, both in clinical settings and to promote and preserve health and well-being in healthy individuals. One main focus of her work is determining how yoga and meditation influence brain structure and how these changes influence behavior. She's been practicing yoga and mindfulness meditation since 1994 and is a board member of the Institute for Meditation and Psychotherapy. Now, let's get to the interview. Dr. Sarah Lazar, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Well, I'm really excited to have you on because you're one of the stars in the world of meditation research. So it's a real treat.
Ah, well, it's always good to be able to talk to people about it.
Yeah, great. Hey, what's the weather like there in the Boston-Cambridge area right now?
Today, it's beautiful. I think it's up in the 50s or maybe even the 60s and sunny and bright and no clouds and a nice change from all the rain we had earlier this summer.
Oh, that sounds delightful. I spent 2 years on exchange at the University of New Hampshire, and so I got to spend time there in the Boston-Cambridge area, and I miss it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful place to live.
Yeah, I think the fall would be a great time there, too. Well, getting on with things here, you're a meditator yourself, right?
Correct, yes.
Yeah, tell us about that. How did you get into that?
Well, I actually started with yoga. I was a runner back in high school and college, and I had a training-related injury, and I was told I should stop running, and instead I should do some stretching. And as I left the physical therapist's office, I saw an ad for yoga, and I thought, oh, that might be a fun way to stretch and stay in shape. But after about a month, I was totally hooked on yoga. I never went back to running. And from the yoga, I then got interested in meditation because there's always a little bit of meditation at the end of the yoga class. And, so by the end of graduate school, I decided that I really wanted to understand what was going on in my yoga and meditation practice and to better understand why and how it was working. And I got very lucky. I found some people who were willing to take me in and train me, and here I am.
Now, you were in graduate school. What were you specializing in?
I cloned genes out of bacteria.
Oh, my goodness. Now, as a psychologist or in some other discipline?
Nope, in molecular biology. That's my training is in molecular biology, and so I completely switched. I have no formal training whatsoever in psychology. But being in a psychiatry department surrounded by psychiatrists and psychologists, I've picked up quite a bit. And obviously, I would never be able to practice, but it's really an understanding of what's altered in the brains of people with these different diseases, and it's definitely coming at from a neurological point of view.
Well, what an interesting pathway into this work you've had. Was it a difficult area to break into? You know, you mentioned, you know, you were in a totally different area. How hard was it for you to break into this?
Not necessarily hard, just long. And there's just a lot to learn. You know, you go to grad school and you spend 5-6 years learning all this information. And, you know, it took me, you know, a couple of years to learn it as well. So, you know, but I mean, it's all very straightforward. It just, you know, it just takes time to learn it all.
Well, I noticed that a lot of your work so far has been with Dr. Herbert Benson, who's well known for the relaxation response. How did that come about?
Right. So he was interested in adding neuroimaging, and he contacted someone named George Bush, who is a resident and no relation whatsoever to the president, and you know, who he knew through various contacts, who is a neuroimager. And I also know George. And so I was talking to George one day and, you know, mentioned my interest in meditation, and he's like, oh, well, we're starting a study on meditation. And, you know, I got involved in that project, and it just sort of took off from there.
Well, you were kind of in the right place at the right time.
Completely, yeah.
Yeah, with a lot of the right background. Now, I'm thinking back to the early days of computing when people had to sign up for time on the mainframe, and they had to have a significant grant money to pay for that time. Was it hard to get access to the fMRI for brain imaging? Is it a similar kind of dynamic, or is it different?
A little bit. The center is good. It knows that it's really hard to get funding, and so it provides quite a bit of development time. So if you have a good idea and a decent track record, you can often get, you know, some scan time pro bono. But obviously the vast majority of time you definitely need grant money. But then also for that first study, Dr. Benson had some seed money to do that project. And so that's how we were able to do that first study.
And, you know, this is all way over my head. How technical is it to learn to use the fMRI device? Does that have a long and steep learning curve?
Yeah, that was definitely much harder to learn than the psychology. You know, but again, you know, just little bit by little bit. You know, and luckily here at the center, there's just a ton of people who do MRI research, and so there's a lot of people I could learn from. And, you know, just it's, you know, just slow and steady, but, you know, you slowly learn it.
Okay. Well, you published a study with others in 2000 on functional brain mapping of the relaxation response in meditation. And I guess you already had your PhD at that point, right?
Correct, yes.
But you had been in this long apprenticeship. Tell us about the design and the findings of that study, if you would.
Right. So the first study, it was a study of 6 people who practiced Kundalini yoga and meditation. And so Kundalini yoga, it's a mantra-based meditation, and as such, it's a little bit different than the Buddhist mindfulness meditation, which is very popular right now.
Yes.
In that it uses a mantra. And but again, that was through my work with Dr. Benson. You know, he had a collaboration with the Kundalini group. And so he very much wanted to study them. So, you know, and I also practice yoga, not Kundalini yoga, but, you know, a different yoga. So I thought, sure, let's try it. So they went to the scanner, and first they sat there and did nothing. And then they did their mantra meditation. And then they, we wanted a task that was kind of sort of like meditation, but not meditation. So we wanted like a sustained attention task that they could do verbally to themselves, silently to themselves.
Yes.
And so we had them randomly generate the names of animals. So dog, pig, cat.
Okay.
So they did that for a few minutes. And so then they would just alternate doing that task with the meditation. And that way we were able to compare periods of rest, periods of this random animal name task, and periods of meditation. And what we found was that numerous brain regions lit up. And in particular, we found the cingulate was one of the regions we found, and also various regions involved in attention and awareness were involved. And so that was, you know, the main point of that study, though, I'd say, was just showing that, yeah, you know, you could do it in the scanner and that it was possible to see something in the scanner. Because I think a lot of people thought, oh, you know, you'd never be able to meditate in the scanner, or that they're going to space out and that, you know, meditation's just lying there doing nothing. You know, these are all the critics. And so they didn't think we'd ever see anything. But lo and behold, we found a very, very nice pattern of activity.
Well, is this machine a lot like the MRI? I've had MRIs where you have to lay in this white tube on a bed, and It's very small, and some people get claustrophobic, and there are these loud clicking sounds. Is that
exactly? Yep. In fact, if anything, it's a little bit louder. It's the exact same machine. They have to put on a special. It's sort of like a catcher's mask that comes down over the head, and that's a special. It's called a head coil, which collects a little bit different data than you would collect if you're just taking a picture of, say, your knee, you know, or something like that. And so, just very, very, very high resolution pictures of the brain. But yeah, it's exactly the same machine.
Yeah, interesting. Let me ask what might be a naive question, but why would focusing on a mantra be better than be different than focusing on animal names?
Well, that was a big question. Would it be? And yeah. In fact, we found some regions the same, but there was more activity in those regions during the meditation. And also, there were some regions that were unique to the meditation, and it's been almost 10 years, and I don't remember exactly what those regions were. But I should know that. But definitely, all the regions were more active during meditation than during the animal names. And the reason why it should be different, partly because when you do the mantra, or at least the way they're taught to do the mantra, it's in conjunction with the breath. So as you say the mantra, you know, you always inhale and exhale to various parts of the mantra. So as you inhale, you say wahe, and as you exhale, you say Guru Nam. And also they place significance on those words. Like, they know what those words mean, and it means something to them, and they're trying to engender certain mind states and qualities as they say those mantra words. But I think the main thing was also that they use the mantra as a way to extend the breathing, especially in yogic meditation techniques. There's a strong emphasis on slowing down the breathing rate, because as you slow down the breathing rate, you calm your autonomic nervous system and you calm the mind. And so there's a lot of emphasis on that. And so, that's probably the main reason. Whereas when they're doing animals, it's just dog, pig, cat, no awareness of the breath whatsoever. So it was attention, but without any of this extra elements.
You know, in a certain way, you and I have followed a similar trajectory, in as much as when I was in graduate school in my doctoral program, I got injured doing sport judo, and I ended up taking up yoga. And for my doctoral dissertation, I wanted to do a study on meditation. And of course, this is all before the imaging was available. And reading from the conclusion section of that paper, you write, the results indicate that the practice of meditation activates neural structures involved in attention and control of the autonomic nervous system. And this was so exciting to me to read, because my doctoral dissertation back in 1970, I hypothesized that the focus of attention is of major importance in meditation and also hypnosis. But as I say, we didn't have access to any kind of brain imaging tools. And so, you know, what I did was very primitive by today's standards. But it's exciting to me to see that neurologically there is this emerging understanding of and focus on attention and its importance.
Yeah, no, attention, that's actually we've done a little bit with attention, hasn't been published yet, but there have been now several studies which really nicely document that attention increases as a result of meditation practice. And so they've both looked at long-term meditators versus controls, and also they've taken novices who've never meditated, and they've tested them before and after learning how to meditate, and they've also taken long-term meditators before and after retreats. And in all those cases, you find, you know, there's increases in attention on, you know, well-validated tests of attention. And those are, you know, nicely published studies that have been published in good journals. And Yes, I think the effect on attention is pretty well established now.
Yes, yes. Now, I noticed that your study had only 5 subjects, and I recall being brainwashed in graduate school to believe that, quotes, real research, and maybe because you come out of a different field, maybe you didn't get the same brainwashing, but that, quotes, real research required large number of subjects. Can you explain to our listeners why a small number of subjects should be taken seriously in this sort of research?
Right. Well, so that first study, I mean, I don't think it was meant to be definitive about what happens in the brain when you meditate. It was definitely meant to be a pilot study, not a full-blown study. And agreed that, yeah, 5 is much, much too small. But it was, like I said, the main purpose was just to say that, yeah, it is possible to have people meditate in the scanner and get meaningful data.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, and some initial ideas of where in the brain might be active. So now in our new study, which we hope to publish soon, we have 20 people per group, which again is still small by some standards, but for imaging, that's actually pretty good. Most imaging studies have about 15, so, you know, 15 to 20. So, you know, 20 is pretty nice. And so there, you know, and this is with the Buddhist meditators who are doing, insight meditation, which is sometimes referred to as mindfulness meditation.
Yes.
Which is just awareness of the breath. And there we're finding the insula being active. And it's really sort of interesting. What we're finding is that, and this is, again, relative to rest and to a control task. And this time, because in the first study with the animals, people kept going back to cat and dog and, you know, farm animals, and they couldn't think of different ones. So we switched and we have them now do random number generation because we figured there's infinite number of numbers and they can pick any and they don't have to go back and repeat. And so we have them do random number generation, lying there doing nothing, and breath awareness meditation. And relative to both rest and random number generation, we're finding the insula specifically being activated, and also that the activity in the insula is corresponding with the changes in breathing rate. So we're showing that, insula is very much aware, involved in awareness and attention and control of awareness and control of sort of awareness of the body. But it's also known to be involved in regulating the autonomic nervous system. And so it's really nice that we're finding the insula because it really explains a lot of the effects of meditation, both in that it's attention, it's awareness, it's also control of autonomic nervous system. It's also integration of emotions and thoughts. So it does a lot. And that's exactly what we're seeing is that during meditation, it gets ramped up and it's actually controlling breathing while you're paying attention to the breath.
Now, where the heck is the insula? Because back when I took physiological psychology, nobody mentioned anything called the insula.
it's really interesting. It's very old in terms of evolution, part of it is. And if you look, it's cortex, but it's not on the visible surface. If you call looking at a brain, it looks sort of like a catcher's mitt, you know, sort of like the hand and then the thumb kind of comes down at the bottom.
Yes.
And sort of that webbing, like where the thumb, between the thumb and the forefinger, like that in there, between the it's called the temporal lobe of the brain and the rest of the brain, you know, sort of up above it. If you stick your finger in that crease back in there is this insula cortex.
And is it an actual structure, or is it more something that's kind of functionally defined?
Well, it's cortex. So cortex is everything on the outer surface of the brain.
Yes.
And then down below the cortex, there's mostly white matter, but then there's also the limbic system. So the hippocampus, the amygdala, the caudate, as well as the brainstem, so in the cerebellum. And the thalamus, you know, those are all sort of subcortical structures. But the cortex is really thought to be like the thinking part of the, you know, computational part of the brain in terms of the sort of higher order processes. And so, and what's nice about the insula is that it's actually, because it's phylogenetically very old, it actually has characteristics of both, mm-hmm. and it's thought to really integrate most of the cortex with the limbic system. Because a lot of the limbic system does not have direct connections, and so it really integrates the limbic system with the rest of the cortex.
So it's sort of a mediator between those two systems.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Now, in 2005, you published a second study, Meditation Experiences Associated with Increased Cortical Thickness. And I think it was this paper that caught the attention of the popular press because, as you say, it was the first research to provide structural evidence for experience-dependent cortical plasticity associated with meditation practice. Now, tell us a bit about that.
Right. So that study, again, had 20 people. It had 20 long-term meditators and 15 controls. So the controls are people who had, you know, little, if any, you know, not more than 4 meditation or yoga classes in their life, but were matched demographically for, you know, age, education, race, gender. And we just put them in the scanners, and we took, so I should back up. So there's 2 ways to use the MRI scanners in the brain. One is functional MRI. And in functional MRI, you're looking at activity in the brain. You know, so what happens in the brain during task A versus task B. The other way is looking at the structure. And so that is not activity, but actually like how much gray matter you have. And again, gray matter is the part of the brain that's actually doing all the computations. That's where the action is, in the gray matter. And other people have shown, for instance, that musicians have more gray matter in areas related to music than non-musicians. And, you know, athletes have more gray matter in their motor cortex compared to non-athletes. And there was one study which actually showed over time that if you take people who've never juggled before, you scan them, you teach them how to juggle, and then you scan them again, the part of the brain that's involved in detecting motion actually grows in just 3 months.
Wow.
And you can actually see growth of that region. And so it really is consistent with that, the idea that, you know, your brain grows and learn when it learns something new. And and so we thought, okay, well, you know, 3 months of juggling, meditators, these guys have been practicing for years, 40 minutes a day for years. You know, maybe there'll be some differences in their brain and actually how much gray matter they have. So we looked, and lo and behold, they had more gray matter in the insula, which again is this really cool area, as well as areas involved in sensory awareness. So for instance, the area representing the diaphragm was a little bit bigger. Also areas of visual cortex and auditory cortex were bigger. And finally, an area in the front of the brain that's involved in a sort of attention and working memory was also bigger. And that region, was cool about that spot, and which got a lot of press, is that it's well known that the entire brain shrinks with age. So it's as big as it's going to get in our early 20s, and then after that, it starts to shrink. And that's why, you know, as it shrinks, that's why, you know, as we get older, you know, this is completely normal shrinkage. You know, this is, you know, normal aging. And this is why it gets hard to remember where we left our keys and what someone's name is, and the sort of the normal, loss of our cognitive functions as we get older is due in part to this loss of gray matter. And this is across the entire brain. But what we found is that one spot in the meditators was as big in the 50-year-olds as it was in the 25-year-olds, suggesting that the meditation helped slow or reverse this gradual loss of gray matter due to age.
I was very excited to read that, by the way, as an older person.
Yeah, a lot of people were excited about that one, actually. So, yeah. Yeah.
Now, you're observing these structural differences, you know, via this machine. I'm just wondering, has there been any sort of confirmation by looking at actual brains, you know, to see that, in fact, there is the kind of thickening? I'm sure that maybe not with these particular meditators, but somewhere along the line, has anybody established that, in fact, there is that relationship?
Right. So the first few studies did with Huntington's
chorea.
Exactly. What they did is they had, you know, families who were willing to donate their brains to science. And so they would scan those brains of people very shortly after, or maybe it was actually, you know, when they were very old and ill, they'd scan them. And then after they passed away, they were able to do, you know, autopsies, and they were actually able to show very good correspondence between the, you know, the thickness of the gray matter measured, you know, by hand on a real brain and what was observed in the MRI.
Okay, good. Yeah. I thought that might be important to establish. Are there any skeptics, by the way? You know, my experience in psychology is that for any study that's ever been done, it seemed like there were people who are critical of it. What do skeptics say about this research?
Right. Oh, yeah, there's tons of them. A lot of people, think meditation, you're just lying there doing nothing. And so, of course, the critics are saying, well, because it's cross-sectional, right? We took long-term meditators. People have been practicing for 10, 20 years. And so they said, well, maybe people with thicker cortex in those regions would, for some reason, be drawn to meditation. And, that's reasonable. Or that so many of them were vegetarian, or, and obviously they took a lot of time out of their lives to, rest and relax. So, the critics would always say it was just those things. Mm-hmm. It had nothing to do with meditation, and it had to do with just who they were as people. They're different. And that's just who they are. And that has nothing to do with the practice of meditation. So in the paper, though, we make the point that the thickness of the insula was tightly correlated to the total number of hours the person had spent actually meditating.
Uh-huh.
And it's also correlated with the number of years of practice, but it is more tightly correlated with the number of hours. And that's important because some people just practice 40 minutes a day. Maybe 40 minutes a day every day. Some people only practice, say, 4 or 5 times a week. Some people, though, go on retreats and have been on many, many retreats where you're practicing 10 to 15 hours a day. And, if you go enough of those retreats, that's going to certainly add up over time. And so we had several people who all had, 10 to 15 years of practice, but huge variations in total number of hours of practice because of variations in how much they practiced daily and how many retreats they had been on. And so that's where we saw this nice correlation with amount of practice, of actual practice versus years of practice.
Yes.
And if it was something that had to do with, say, diet or exercise or these sorts of things, you'd expect it to be the other way around. It'd be more tightly correlated with number of years as opposed to number of hours. But now we have brand new data, which is not yet published, but we're hoping to get published soon, where we actually have taken people who've never meditated before, and then we scan them, taught them to meditate for 2 months, scan them again, and we're finding, and this is actually the MBSR course started by Jon Kabat-Zinn, we're finding from before to after that the insula actually grows. So now we know for sure that it really is the insula growing and not just people are weird and different and strange.
Yay!
Yeah.
Yay for our side. Oh, that's really, that's really fascinating. It reminds me of Malcolm Gladwell. I think it was in his most recent book I think he was citing research. I'm not sure, but there was the claim that in general, it seems to take 10,000 hours to achieve mastery of whether it's a musical instrument or some other kind of discipline.
Uh-huh.
Somehow that seems to be related to what you're talking about.
Oh, definitely, yeah. It's, it definitely takes many, many hours. And anyone who practices will tell you, that the more you practice, the more it develops and deepens and, you're constantly discovering new things and reaching a new level of practice. And certainly I think we saw that in the brains that there was, and also because the other thing we looked at actually was breathing rate. And what we found is actually that people who had less than about 5,000 hours, there was some change in their breathing rate, but not much, maybe just 1 breath per minute, 2 breaths per minute. But then once you got past that 5,000 hour limit, you then saw this really nice decrease, and that was very tightly correlated with number of hours of practice again. And so, once you got past 5-6,000 hours, it really started to decrease and got down to, say, 4, 5, 8 breaths per minute change during meditation relative to baseline. So, it really does suggest that there is a continuing process due to meditation.
That's really interesting. So whether it's meditation or learning music or painting, we're in a sense, we're growing our brains. We're growing a new brain or an augmented brain.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow. On your website, I see also that you conducted a 2006 study on association between oxygen consumption and nitric oxide production during the relaxation response. Is that kind of what you were just speaking about or something different?
That's something different. And actually, I was only peripherally involved in that one. Jeffrey Dusek was the lead on that one. But what that was with the relaxation response and that, so Herbert Penson's intervention. And we should probably say something about that at the moment. So there's been two stress reduction courses that have been developed that are based on meditation. One is Herbert Benson developed one called the relaxation response. And it incorporates sort of a mantra. So they don't call it a mantra, they call it a focus word, but it's the same idea as a mantra where you, again, you say one word over and over again on the breath. It also incorporates, breath awareness meditation, but it also incorporates several other techniques that they have developed themselves. Other people have also developed, say guided imagery, and just this deep relaxation, like progressive muscle relaxation techniques, to elicit the relaxation response. And so they feel that meditation is just one method for eliciting relaxation, and that it's the relaxation that is the key component to health that meditation benefits.
Right.
And then on the other camp, you have Jon Kabat-Zinn, who develops mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is based pretty closely just on insight, Vipassana meditation, mindfulness meditation. And so that has a little bit of yoga, but it's a very slow, gentle yoga. And all the meditation is this breath awareness, mindful breath awareness meditation. And so the nitric oxide taper that you mentioned, that is with Herbert Benson's relaxation response. And so one idea that they have, so they've done a lot of work showing different markers of relaxation increase when you practice these techniques. And so nitric oxide, that's like laughing gas, right?
Right.
And it's, your cells actually produce tiny amounts of it. And it's involved in physical relaxation. So for instance, it causes your blood vessels to dilate, and which is, when you relax, that's one thing that happens. And it's also a signaling molecule. It does various things inside cells to, that's consistent with relaxation and producing, physiological states that are consistent with, say, healing and relaxation. And so what they found was that at the pre-time point, before anyone had any practice, they would listen to these tapes and you should listen to the relaxation response. And they produced a little bit of nitric oxide, but there wasn't really any correlation between how much they produced and, it's sort of all over the place. Whereas after 8 weeks of practice, they then found this nice shift. So when they went from sitting there doing nothing to the relaxation response, they got this nice burst of nitric oxide. And it sort of continued over the course of the few minutes that they were practicing it. So that's really a marker of relaxation, more than anything.
Okay, that's fascinating. So do you think your research suggests that everyone would benefit from meditation?
Oh, I don't like making grand sweeping statements like that. in theory, probably most people could benefit from it. I think there needs to be some caveats, and I think that's important. So for instance, just like everyone would benefit from physical exercise. But in reality, if you have serious heart disease, you want to be very careful. If someone has a serious heart disease and goes into the doctor's not going to say, oh, go start running. You start with walking, and you do it very carefully. You're closely monitored by a doctor. You're very careful about how you begin. So I think for people who are more or less healthy, psychologically healthy, I think meditation is great. For people with really serious psychological conditions, so for instance, schizophrenia, prone to psychotic breaks, you want to be really, really careful. And, it may actually be counterindicated for people like that. And certainly, just as the heart patient, would only do it under close doctor supervision, I think those patients, you'd only do it under very, very, very close supervision of a mental health professional. Just because there is this potential for, it's fairly well known that, people when they meditate, there is the possibility for psychotic breaks. So, you do want to, be very careful. Also, anyone who has had any serious trauma, you want to proceed with great, great caution.
Okay, well, those are good caveats to mention. What sorts of brain meditation studies are needed in the future? In other words, what sorts of questions still remain?
Oh, many. how does it work? I think we're really just starting to scratch the surface.
Yeah.
There's a lot to be done. So certainly, I think it's been shown that meditation reduces stress and it promotes attention. But that's, just the beginning. So how does that then lead to emotion regulation? How does that, how is it that, and when you think about it, it's really kind of amazing. All you're doing is sitting and watching your breath. And yet that leads to you know, emotion regulation and stress reduction, and but also spirituality and changes in interpersonal relationships, and you know, just a whole, you know, better health, you know, physical health, better mental health. So you know, understanding how you go from that really simple practice of sitting and watching your breath to all these, you know, such wide-ranging benefits. You know, that I think there's not at all clear how that happens. Again, we're starting to have some clues, but you know, we're really just beginning to see that. And also, again, I'd say that what you see in the course of 8 weeks of, say, of a relaxation sponsor MBSR training is really just the beginning. You know, and so it's nice looking at these long-term meditators to sort of see sort of what the potential is of the human mind. Because especially if you look at these monks, you know, and I don't look at monks, I just look at long-term practitioners who are just everyday people. But the monks, you know, you're seeing some really amazing things in their brains. So, you know, understanding what the ramifications of those changes are, I think is going to be very interesting.
Well, speaking of the monks, I'm sure you know Dr. Richie Davidson's work. I'm going to be interviewing him soon. Do you have any advice for a penetrating question that I might ask him?
I had to think about that one. Sorry.
I guess I do too then. I was hoping you'd get me off the hook.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, the question you just asked me, like, you know, what is there to do? I mean, there's just, it's, you know, what is the potential, you know, the maximum potential? I mean, is that is sort of an interesting question. I mean, there's lots of interesting questions. And another thing that's nice is that, because we're using slightly different tools, because I'm really looking at the structure of the brain, whereas his lab, particularly Antoine Lutz, looks a lot at, you know, at EEGs, which is sort of brain activity in real time. And that's different than fMRI, which is, yes, they're both looking at activity, but they're different.
Yes.
And they're finding slightly different things. So, you know, trying to understand how those interrelate is sort of interesting thing to do in the future, I think. Yeah, no, but there's so much to do. There's so much to do.
Well, what would be your advice to any students who might be listening and who might want to get into the sort of research that you've been conducting?
Right. Well, so that's a question we get a lot. And, you know, everyone wants to do research on this.
Yeah.
And at this point, I'm not aware of, like, any programs really per se that are devoted to mindfulness. There might be now because there's so much demand for it. But there are people all over the place who are starting to do research on this. And so I think what I would say, the most important thing is to get a good education and a good training in how to do research, and then take those tools and apply them to meditation. Another thing to remember is, like I said, so we know that it affects attention, but it also affects emotion. And so I'd say find, you know, something that you're interested in and then see how meditation affects that process. So if you're interested in attention, go to a lab that's, you know, studying attention, learn how to do good research on attention, and then add in the meditation. You know, or if you're interested in emotion or some aspect of emotion regulation or vision or cognition or, you know, memory or whatever, you know, find a lab that does that and then add the meditation in. I think that's the best way to go.
Okay, well, that sounds like great advice. As we wrap up here, is there anything else that you'd like to say?
I recommend people to at least try meditation, because I think it's one thing to hear about it, but, you know, it's sort of, the analogy I always make is, how do you explain color to someone who's blind? And there's no way to explain color. You can only experience it. And similarly with meditation, there is this subjective feeling and these experiences that you have when one meditates that's really hard to describe. And, you know, and so I think a lot of people who haven't practiced, you know, they poo-poo it and they don't understand it because they haven't tried it. And, you know, words just don't do it justice. And so just as, you know, if you can't understand color without seeing it, you can't really understand yoga meditation without trying it firsthand.
Well, that's a great close. Dr. Sara Lazar, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you were as fascinated by this conversation with Dr. Sara Lazar and her groundbreaking work as I was. I also hope you'll forgive my excitement about yet another study pointing to the key role of attention in meditation. I suppose it's fairly obvious now. Perhaps it wasn't quite so obvious back in 1970 when I did my own doctoral dissertation at the University of Michigan. Inasmuch as I was in the clinical psychology program, training to be a psychotherapist, I was at a real disadvantage when it came time to come up with a doctoral dissertation. I say disadvantage in relation to non-clinical students who did long apprenticeships with the professor who would eventually become chair of their committee. Typically, they would have worked on that professor's research as a research assistant for 2 or 3 or even more years. They might have even had the opportunity to be a co-author on 1 or more research papers. When it came time to do their own doctoral research, they would have been already steeped in the relevant research literature, and their doctoral research would be some variation on their professor's research that had yet to be explored. I, by contrast, as a clinical student, had not gone through any sort of research apprenticeship. Rather, I was a teaching fellow and was putting myself through grad school, teaching undergraduate courses, and also was committed to half-time clinical internships while those other students were doing research assistantships. So I was really up against it when it came time to do my doctoral research. I made several false starts until a faculty member to whom I'll be forever grateful challenged me to figure out what I was really interested in and to come up with something around that interest that would be really authentic for me. Well, at that time, like my guest Sarah Lazar, I was very involved with yoga. I also had a long-standing interest in hypnosis and other altered states of consciousness. The hypothesis I decided to test was that the ability to focus one's attention would be a key determinant of both successful meditation and hypnotic susceptibility. I came up with the idea of having subjects focus on their breath or on a candle flame and press a button on a counter every time they realized they needed to bring their attention back to the meditative task. I hypothesized that those who made fewest button clicks would also make the best hypnotic subjects. The professors on my committee had no idea what I was up to or why I thought this should be important. It didn't really tie into their research, but fortunately, I was able to round up 3 guys who believed in me enough to be on my committee. The correlation I hypothesized turned out to be very slight, probably due to the crudeness of the measurement tools that were available at that time. Nevertheless, after I graduated and it got published, it was seen as groundbreaking research in some quarters at that time. This was a bit before the big yoga and meditation boom, and certainly before what would become a wave of research on meditation. So, as someone who had very low self-confidence at that time, I can't help but feel some pride and blow my own horn in at least having had the prescience to pick up on what would become a major trend, both in psychology and society at large. I hope my story will encourage you to follow your own hunches, whether you be psychology graduate student or, quotes, just a student of life.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. And Dr. Dave is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Exploring the spirit and our psyche, we are learning to unwind. And Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. We're all in your mind. We're all in.
I had a delightful interview 2 days ago with Australian dream analyst Jane Teresa Anderson. I had asked listeners to send in some dreams for her to analyze. I did get a few, but have received some that were too late. I now realize I should have announced the interview date, so please accept my apologies if you sent in a dream and it was too late to get analyzed. Be sure to catch my interview with Dr. Elisha Goldstein on my other series at wisecounselpodcast.com, where you'll also find a written transcript right on the page with the audio interview. The focus of the interview is on using mindfulness to deal with stress in the workplace. You may recall that Dr. Goldstein was a guest about a year ago on Shrink Wrap Radio number 152. Let me call your attention to the fact that there are no commercials in this episode, other than for Shrink Wrap Radio. There was not the initial ad spot called a pre-roll that you usually hear when the show first starts, and you'll not hear me promote any other sponsors on this episode. As I've mentioned before, I'd really like to move to a donation-only model. I've never been thrilled with the pre-roll idea. My ad revenue for the past 3 months was a whopping $30 per month. Now, that could be replaced by just three of you taking out a 12-month subscription at $10 per month. If you consider both Shrink Wrap Radio and the Wise Counsel podcast, you're getting 4 in-depth interviews a month, month in and month out. So that's about half the price of a latte for each episode. If you haven't subscribed yet, please go to our site and click on the big green donate button now. If between now and the next show, I get enough new year-long subscriptions at either $5 or $10 a month to replace the current ad revenue of $30 a month, the ads will go away. So do it today, and thank you. And thank you also, all of you who've made previous donations and subscriptions as well. If you have a cell phone, let me remind you that another way you can get these shows is through the Stitcher application. You'll find a link to Stitcher on our website. Let me remind you also to join our Yahoo discussion group. There's a banner link on the website in the right-hand sidebar. Or you can simply send an email to shrinkwrapradio-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. And finally, please remember to tell your friends, colleagues, family, and so on about Shrink Wrap Radio. And I really appreciate it when you mention it on your blog, your Facebook, your Twitter. And by the way, you can follow my tweets at twitter.com/shrinkwrapradio.
Hi, this is dream analyst and author Jane Teresa Anderson in Brisbane, Australia, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Jane Teresa. You'll be hearing more from her on our next episode. In the meantime, let's dip into our listener mailbag. First, we hear from Louise in Dublin. Hi, Dr. Dave. My name is Louise, and I live in Dublin, Ireland. I've listened to so many of your invaluable podcasts and been inspired by them. I am almost finished with my art psychotherapy training, which I'm doing in Belfast, and really wanted to set up a website and podcast facility about the creative therapies. I realize there is a podcast out there for this, but I found it inadequate and wish to do something along the lines of what you provide. My only problem is that I have no idea how to podcast. I can set up a website, but that's about it. Would you mind giving me some advice or pushing me in the right direction? I would really appreciate the help. Thank you, Louise. Louise and anyone else who's interested, you can see what I'm using for podcasting by going to the Shrink Wrap Radio website and taking a look under the About Dr. Dave tab at the top of the site. Of course, it can be done for a lot less than I've spent. My setup has evolved over the past 5 years, and I did have some additional private communication with Louise, giving her some more advice. Next, we hear from Andrew in the UK. Dear Dr. Dave, I'm writing you from London, UK, not Ontario. I discovered your podcast about a year back and want to let you know how much I'm enjoying it and appreciate the effort you put in as well as your deft interviewing skills. Thank you. He says in parentheses, if you want to feel extra pleased with yourself, take into account that I'm British and not naturally given to expressing appreciation. This is a first. Well, double thank you, triple thank you. He goes on to say, I'm a neophyte counselor, and I found your podcast a rich source of information. In particular, your interview with David Wallen on wise counsel fascinated me. I'm finishing up his book now. Don't think I've ever underlined anything so much, and I feel it's the book I've been looking slash waiting for to make sense of more of my own and others' early experience. Yes, I found that to be true as well. In terms of my personal development, I found many of your interviews and subsequent book purchases very valuable, and they often seem to have a synchronistic feel to them in terms of stuff I'm dealing with slash thinking about. Judith Orloff to help me with psychic protection. Okay, she's a bit preachy, but definitely on to something. I spent 35 plus years with the lid jammed on, and the last 5 at the other extreme, suddenly wide open and unprotected, which has been cool and overwhelming at the same time. Roger Kamenetz's book has given me a new and more structured way of thinking about my dreams. They are long and rambling, and I've never felt able to go the association route. I liked how you stayed with it, sensing that there was something to the first interview that you weren't grasping. I had written it off after the first interview, so thanks for sticking with it. I knew Kamenetz was a good writer. I read The Jew and the Lotus years back, which is must-be reading for any Jew interested in the interface of Judaism and spirituality. And on that note, I just heard your interview with Abner Weiss. I'm keen to read his book, as I've struggled for years to reconcile being Jewish with where my soul has found nourishment in transpersonal psychology. I've been around the Jewish block, and he's the first guy I've really heard speak both languages. Finding the feminine face of God was a real gift. It spoke strongly to me. Dean Radin, etc., etc. I'm telling my friends about the site and have made a small donation. I'm not working due to being in rehab from a back injury, so it's really small. I'd be delighted to meet you if you're in London sometime and would like to drink tea. Best wishes, Andrew. P.S. I'm continually amazed at how much creativity there is in psycho-spiritual matters in the U.S. You may have 6 times the population, but it seems there is 60 times the imagination as over here. I always felt it was some kind of karmic error that I wasn't born in the Bay Area. Oh well, I spent several years living in America. It's where I feel most at ease with the people and the place. Thinking about it now, maybe part of why I feel so drawn to your podcast is that it connects me into that broadness of mind and pioneering spirit that is the promise of America. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for everything that you've said in this email. Very reinforcing, I must say, and surely you are indeed a kindred spirit. Next, we hear from Lisa, who writes, I want to thank you for the lovely interview with Leslie Davenport about imagery. It made my day. I noticed that as a shamanic practitioner, I start my journey or the guided journey of a client or a group exactly the same way, with having a person or all mentally go to a nice place in nature, etc., etc. We would be in another journey if it is a beginner's group, look for our power animal, in another one for our teacher for whom we ask questions, each for himself, of course. I should maybe explain that the method I use is called the Harner method, developed by Michael Harner and later others. You know, Michael Harner is kind of on my list of people to interview because he's fairly local to me. Anyway, getting back to the letter, it is basically a shamanism stripped of its religious context. It can be used for healing, for getting advice, and of course to relax and enter another world. I think one could say the participants are in a sort of half-trance state, not in full trance. Time and time again, they experience wonderful images and get great advice. The most fascinating part for me is, quote, soul retrieval, where shamanic practitioner goes into his client's past when asked to do so in order to fix something bad that happened to the client when they were younger or even little. Oh, there would be a lot to tell about this. Well, you know, if you haven't, you should check out my previous episodes on shamanism, especially the one with Alberto Violdo, as well as some others. She goes on, I was so happy, especially about this interview and about Leslie Davenport, her knowledge and her approach, because here again I saw something that I wish would happen more and more in the future, the connection of medicine and psychology with old indigenous wisdom, or old spiritual wisdom, one might say, all to the best of humans to get healed and to get whole. I want to thank you for doing this great work. I enjoy the interviews a lot, and I'm trying to catch up with some. I found it absolutely intriguing that you agreed to be the client for Leslie's short demonstration of imagery. Thank you very much for sharing something very personal, and please visit the waterfall again, Lisa. And she is referring to, I guess, the waterfall place that I visited in the guided imagery that Leslie did with me. Finally, let's read one more. This one is from Louise in Canada, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, I am the Canadian listener who bought your CD. She's referring to the Dream CD that's in the store on our website. Let me encourage you to follow suit. She goes on to say, I was thrilled to be mentioned when you plugged your CD at the end of Robert Cull's interview. My 15 seconds of fame, and honored to be the first to purchase it. I can't begin to tell you how much I enjoy your podcast, the breadth of knowledge and understanding you bring to the microphone, and the openness and clarity with which you interact with your guests make for a joyful listening experience. You may be interested in hearing Robert Cull's interview on CBC's, and that would be the Canadian Broadcasting Company, Tapestry, hosted by Mary Hines. She is also in my top five interviewers. It is available through iTunes, and she also gives a web address. I'm sure you can find it on your own if you're interested. She says, if I may suggest a future guest, Anne Harrington gave a superb interview on CBC's Ideas on September 7, 2009. It also should be available on iTunes. And again, she gives a URL link, which you can look for on your own. She says, but it does not do it justice. I felt the subtlety of the insights Dr. Harrington had on the collective view of the mind-body connection were enlightening, and wish she had talked more about the effects of meditation on consciousness and functionality. She only briefly mentioned towards the end of the interview, perhaps this would be a good takeoff point. I listened to your podcast repeatedly and am still working my way through the archive of both Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel. I look forward to each and every one. Cheers, Louise. And then she adds a P.S. I bought the Shrink Wrap Radio t-shirt through Cafe Press, as I like to spread the word and be a walking billboard is useful towards that end. I feel I should point out that as the image is printed in reverse, the side does not look quite right. Well, thanks for letting me know that. I wasn't aware of that. Also, the blue square is so close to hue to the black of the t-shirt, kind of gets lost in the black. Also, the side does not stand out in the orange and blue squares. Perhaps a logo reworked with different brightnesses of the colors, which would work better with silk screened on black fabric, could be submitted to Cafe Press. You know, I have a black t-shirt as well and saw some of those problems. I would recommend, I want everybody to buy one of these shirts. I don't make any money on them, but they're great advertisement for the show. And I would recommend that if you get one, you get it in white or in yellow. It will show up really well in those two colors. Or if you are somebody with a combination of Photoshop skills and maybe some experience with Cafe Press, I could really use some help making changes to the logo that Louise has suggested here. I think they are beyond my particular skill set. So I think that better wrap it up for today. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments on individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemails on Skype or give me a call. Boy, I haven't had any voice messages in a long time. Just give a call at 206-337-0622. Thanks to my guest, Dr. Sarah Lazar, for sharing about her groundbreaking work on the neuroscience of meditation. And as I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with the Australian dream analyst, Jane Teresa Anderson, and she'll be analyzing some listener dreams as well as a couple of mine. So don't miss it. And without any additional commercial announcements, until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.